6.
I'm Pat Morrison. When tourism became accessible to the middle classes, people went to visit what looked for them to be the exotic places of the world, the great cities of Europe, for example. Now, of course, exotic destinations are still on many people's agendas, but they are exotic destinations that may be changing, in some cases, may be doomed. The tourism of doom is the shorthand for the new kind of tourism that has evolved from ecotourism, the idea of going to see environmentally sensitive places. Now, it may be environmentally sensitive places that are on their way to disappearing, or places like, say, Beijing and in Africa, where the cities and the countryside are changing. The top 10 endangered sites include places like both poles, the city of Venice, which is sinking into the Adriatic, and global warming may make that even worse. In Alaska, melting glaciers are drawing lots of tourists. The Great Barrier Reef in Australia, the Galapagos, again, a popular destination, and Mount Kilimanjaro, made even more famous by the title of the book by Ernest Hemingway, The Snows of Kilimanjaro, the year-round snows themselves may be disappearing from that mountaintop. We'll be talking about ecotourism and the tourism of doom with Kenneth Shapiro. He is the editor-in-chief of Travel Age West. We'll be taking your phone calls as well. Are you one of these tourists or travelers? Are these the destinations you have moved up your list because they may not be there, at least in their present form, in the near future? 866-893-5722 is the number. 866-893-KPCC. Mr. Shapiro, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Pat.
Was it you who coined the phrase tourism of doom?
I think it was, actually. I used it in an editorial. It's a term that we started using at the magazine to describe a trend that we're seeing of people interested in visiting destinations based on those places being threatened by climate change.
Now, are these places, are these visitors, tourists, travelers who may already have seen all of the usual stuff, Europe, the cities of the Mideast, may have gone to China themselves and are looking for something new and novel? Or are these people who say, hey, it's time for us to get a wiggle on?
Well, I do think that these are generally experienced travelers. There's a larger trend right now toward exotic destinations and exotic travel, but this is different in that these places are not just exotic. They're threatened, and they may be seriously altered or even disappear a generation from now.
And what is it that people are coming to you to book trips to see?
Well, they don't actually come to me. I'm the editor of the magazine, but they are coming to travel agents because they're hearing about it in the news quite a bit, and they want to see these places firsthand.
And some of these places are not just wild places in nature like the Spitsbergen Glacier. You have China and Africa in that category.
Yes, exactly. That's right. And you had mentioned Venice, which is pretty well-known. It's sinking into the Adriatic, so that's also a destination people are interested in.
And what reasons do they give? Because these things may be gone?
Well, I don't know if it's the only factor in choosing these places, but it's definitely part of the mindset. And, what you hear is that they want to see this before it changes or it's gone entirely.
Eric Marinoff joins us, too. He is a travel agent and owner of alltravel.com. Mr. Marinoff, thank you.
Good afternoon.
You've been in this business for more than a quarter century. Is this a profound change?
I would have to agree that it is. And I think you hit it exactly on, that it's a combination of destinations that are changing very rapidly, but also from a nature standpoint, those that we question, will they be around in years to come?
Do people actually email and say, book me there quick before it disappears?
Not so much on that level, but I think that, as you said, people are adding them to their lists of things they want to do in life, and they're moving to the top, knowing that these places are changing kind of rapidly.
And Ken Shapiro with Travel Age West, is there a certain type? You said these are usually well-traveled people who've seen all the usual sites already. Is there a characteristic? Could you detail the average tourist of doom?
Well, what I would say is that they're generally a little bit younger, maybe, as they'd say, X-generation travelers, and they're sophisticated travelers. They have been other places before. And as we see, there's a lot of interest in the West because there's a lot of environmental interest in general, I think, in the West versus some of the other places in the country. So it's often affluent, 40-ish Western travelers that that are interested in this.
You mean from the Western United States?
Yes, that's right.
And Eric Marinoff, a lot of these trips sound like places where you don't get off a plane, hail a taxi, go to your hotel, and then get into another taxi to go take a look at something. These can be pretty arduous trips.
Well, you're absolutely right as far as they're not just as simple as hail a cab, as you say. But, you know, so many of these destinations aren't as arduous as they were even a few years ago. There still is a way of traveling to a lot of these destinations in modified version of luxury. And I agree with Ken very much so that it is the more experienced traveler and that, you know, they are looking for that overall experience before it's gone. But they're not sacrificing luxury. There are modifications of luxury.
How much do these trips cost then?
That's a really open question. It can really run the full gamut. Partly depends on the level of luxury one takes it to. I mean, Africa, you can do things from private tented safaris, you know, at the one end to, you know, private flights all over Africa. So your price ranges are quite varied depending on destination and type of trip one's actually planning.
We're asking for your calls about your travel plans, whether this is the kind of travel that interests you, seeing things that are endangered by global warming, perhaps on the cusp of their disappearing from the earth altogether. 866-893-5722, 866-893-KPCC. Herman is calling from downtown L.A. Herman, thanks for the call. Where did you go?
Well, this time last year, I was in Amsterdam.
And why did you choose Amsterdam?
Well, I've been to Europe a number of times, but my family never has. So when we take my family to Europe, first place would be Paris. But then after that, I said, well, let's go see Amsterdam. And my wife says, well, why do you want to go see Amsterdam? And I said, well, because most of that country is below sea level. And Amsterdam is one of these great cities, and you know, I just wouldn't want it to be like a New Orleans that we managed to miss it before it was hit by some catastrophe.
Kenneth Shapiro at Travel Age West, is Herman's sentiment the kind that you hear from readers?
Yeah, quite a bit. There'll be consumers, travelers will be interested in visiting a place such as Europe or South America, but specifically they might alter their travel itineraries to take in places such as Amsterdam in this case, or the Alps, which are also threatened, the glaciers in the Alps, or in South America, for instance, Patagonia or the Galapagos. They'll modify their itineraries to take in some of these destinations because they're concerned that in you know, the next generation, they'll be gone.
And Eric Marinoff with alltravel.com, is Herman's destination of Amsterdam one that you hear from your clients for the same reason?
I've got to confess it's not one that I hear, but I think Herman's got a very valid point. We also never know the way the world may change, and certain places or cities are more threatened than others. I thought it was an interesting comparison with New Orleans. We tend to see people doing more of out-of-city destination because that's where you're going to find more change going on. But nonetheless, I think he brought a real valid point. And then to that, the most important of all is people have to determine their own priority list and the places that they want to get before they change, wherever they may be.
Thank you for your call, Herman. We are taking your calls at 866-893-5722. Why are you choosing your destinations? Are you choosing your travel excursions with an eye to seeing places that may not be there anymore? 866-893-5722. Sarah Benson joins us, too. She's a freelance travel journalist. She's written about disappearing destinations for the Lonely Planet guidebooks, well known, of course, around the planet. Ms. Benson, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Pat.
Now, you have not only written about these places, they have changed the way that you write and think about traveling.
They have. I think when I was a younger backpacker, I went to places that were threatened or endangered without a second thought about the impact that my own travel was going to have on these places. As I've seen indigenous cultures affected, fragile environmental areas take a turn for the worse over my career of traveling for the past 15 years, I've become a bit choosier about the places that I visit, and I would encourage all people who want to go visit these must-see places that might disappear to consider first how their own trip might hasten the demise of these places that we all want to preserve.
It's the idea that each man kills the thing he loves, and in loving a place, you can endanger it.
I agree with that, and I don't think that all the places we've mentioned, for example, Venice or, you know, seeing glaciers in Alaska, not all of these places is your personal impact going to love these places to death, but some of the more fragile areas like the Galapagos Islands, the more people that go, the faster they're going to disappear.
To that end, we have a call from Jacqueline in Pasadena about her brother-in-law. Jacqueline, go ahead.
Hi. My brother-in-law, my ex-brother-in-law, once really shocked me by saying that he wanted to go to Africa and shoot an elephant before they're all gone.
But, of course, he would hasten their disappearing by doing so.
But his brain didn't work that way. It's just so strange that some people just, it's all selfish.
Sarah Benson, do you hear about things like that? That seems just an absolute extreme absurdity, but an extreme example of what you were just talking about.
I certainly have seen it. I do think that that is the extreme edge of this trend that we're seeing right now towards the tourism of doom. I think most people have the right instinct. They understand that the planet is changing, and that consciousness alone is incredibly valuable in the effort to preserve these places. But in terms of searching for truly eco-sensitive tour operators, for example, or considering the carbon footprint of their travel, people, they want to take the next step, but they're not always sure the right questions to ask. So I think people's heart is in the right place, but we're just not seeing that truly eco-conscious or conservative travel angle.
Jacqueline, thank you for your call. I must say, I hope your brother-in-law never got his wish. Sarah, excuse me, let me go to Eric Marinoff. Do people ask about the carbon footprint of their travel, Mr. Marinoff, like the idea of taking a jet and all the fossil fuel that's used to that to go see a place that's disappearing because people are using fossil fuels?
Well, they're not thinking yet on that level itself, but I will say we've seen a huge surge in the overall issue of green travel, and people being more conscious of at least supporting companies or vendors that support green. It's become much more prevalent even in the hotel world, even in major cities. It's become much more so even in the last 6 months to past year.
We have some fabulous calls coming in. We're going to be taking them as we can. Before a break, let's go to Alicia in, must be Huntington Park. Alicia? Huntington Beach.
Yes.
Okay.
I traveled in China. I was a cruise ship director on the Yangtze River, and I got to see all of the farmland and the rural towns before they were all covered by water due to the dam.
And have you been back to see it since?
I have not, unfortunately, but I think that they may. Well, my idea was to have them start doing underwater tours of all the old farmlands and cities and towns.
Wow.
Because they've been lost, and they've lost a lot of culture and people. People have been relocated. They told me that 300 million people had to be relocated just living on the banks of the Yangtze River.
Wow, scuba archaeology. It sounds like you should go back and go into business.
I would love to.
Alicia, thank you very much for your call. Before we go to a break, Kenneth Shapiro, are people coming up with really inventive places to go and ways to see things like Alicia?
Yeah, you do hear about all the time different tours being added and different travel companies that are coming up with some really incredible ideas. One of the things that's especially popular right now is voluntourism, where people will go to some of these places and actually volunteer for a while to do work or to help researchers there, and that will be part of the trip, which I think does help in some of to mitigate some of the destruction that comes from visiting these places. At least, you know, they're giving back at the same time.
When we come back, we're going to be taking more of your calls. Have you gone to places that may be disappearing with an eye to seeing them before they go? What do you assess as the carbon footprint impact of your travel? If you're seeing a place because global warming is endangering it, are you contributing to global warming by going there? It's a difficult and tricky question. The tourism of doom, an outgrowth of ecotourism, and the desire to see places before they change, in some cases irrevocably. Give us a call at 866-893-5722. We'll be back with our guests and more of your calls after this. This is 89.3 KPCC.
Hi, this is Scott Jagow of the Marketplace Morning Report. Our crew comes to work very early every morning, way before the roosters even think about getting up. We do that to help you start the day well-informed. But Marketplace doesn't stop there. Kai Rizdahl and the crew take over for weekday afternoons on KPCC. Tess Vigeland and Chris Farrell are here for Marketplace Money on Sunday at 2 p.m. Listen for all three Marketplace shows here on 89.3 KPCC. And thanks.
This is 89.3 KPCC, LA's radio news leader. Good afternoon. I'm Hedy Lynn Hurdies. Pakistani officials say opposition leader Benazir Bhutto made herself vulnerable to attack when she waved to supporters from her vehicle's sunroof yesterday. They say others inside the vehicle were fine after the bombing and gunfire. Still, officials say Bhutto didn't die from gunshot wounds, but was killed when shockwaves from a bomb explosion caused her head to strike part of the sunroof. Images of fugitives will soon begin popping up on billboards across the country. KPCC Steve Julian has more on the agreement between the FBI and an outdoor advertising company.
The FBI has teamed up with Phoenix-based Clear Channel Outdoor. The company will post photographs of the most wanted bank robbers, violent criminals, and terrorists on digital billboards. The program just completed a successful test run in Philadelphia. An image there led to the arrest of a man in Florida suspected of killing a Philadelphia police officer. Clear Channel is committing 150 digital billboards in 20 cities nationwide, including Atlanta, Cleveland, Indianapolis, Newark, and here in Los Angeles. The company also says it can update messages within minutes and will preempt paid advertising if the FBI needs to broadcast an urgent message. There are about 800 digital billboards in the U.S., according to the Outdoor Advertising Association of America. Steve Julian, 89.3, KPCC.
It's 2:23 at KPCC.
I'm Pat Morrison. First, there was ecotourism, visiting the great green places of the planet, and now there is the tourism of doom and the tourism of change. See places like the snows of Kilimanjaro or perhaps the polar ice caps before they disappear in large part because of global warming, or visit places like China or Africa or India that are in the process of change. We're taking your calls about your tourism along these lines at 866-893-5722. Some great calls, some great guests. Kathy's calling from Altadena. Go ahead, Kathy.
Yes, we went to Borneo this year, Malaysian Borneo, and it is a place where, that you need to go to now rather than waiting because they're building literally 24 hours a day. They have lighted cranes. But there are so many wonderful things to see, and the first reason we went there was because it's much less expensive than going to Europe.
And Sarah Benson, who's written for Lonely Planet, is there the conflict implicit in what Kathy was saying that someone from the West may say, gosh, those rainforests are extraordinary and irreplaceable, and the nation that owns them says, we want to cut them down and build condos?
I definitely think there is some conflict there, but in some cases, tourism to those spots can help preserve them. Once local industry and tourism operators and just the everyday economy of smaller villages in places like Malaysia and Borneo realizes the value in terms of just pure money, economic value that can come from preserving the rainforest for tourists to come and visit in an ecologically sensitive way, it can show them an alternative to the 24-hour-a-day building that the caller referenced.
And Kathy, did you see any evidence of the government there realizing that it had a great cash product right there by leaving the forest intact?
Only in the national parks. Otherwise, the forest was being knocked over to plant palm oil palms.
Boy, Kathy, thank you so much for your call. I envy you that trip. Carolyn is calling from Mission Viejo, and she's going on a cruise. Carolyn, go ahead and tell us about it.
Hi. I'm 67 years old, and I've traveled a lot, hit every continent except for Antarctica, and 2 years ago planned this trip on a luxury liner to Antarctica. It leaves next month, but it was a trip that you had to plan early because it is in such demand. I'm very excited about going down to the Falkland Islands and Tierra del Fuego and parts of Chile and through the Antarctica Peninsula that juts up towards South America. But after listening to your program, now I'm very, very concerned.
Oh.
I mean, I've been concerned about global warming for many, many years, but, you know, I will go on this trip, but I will do what I can to investigate how the ship practices green policies.
Oh gosh, I hope that we didn't ruin it for you guys. I'll go back to Sarah Benson again. Carolyn sounds like a very conscientious person.
I don't mean to be the big naysayer, and I really like what I think. The other guest, Ken, had mentioned earlier that, you know, trying to make sure that your trip has a positive impact either while you're there or when you come back home can be a really good thing to help mitigate the impact of you know, the carbon footprint of your trip or the environmental impact. There's a forthcoming book that's coming out next year from Vintage Press called Disappearing Destinations, and it talks about how in these very threatened and endangered places, if it can inspire travelers to come back and do more to help preserve the environment and fight global warming and all of that, that the inspirational value of the trip can be a positive impact and outcome as well.
Carolyn, thank you so much for the call, and please enjoy the trip with a clear heart. Kenneth Shapiro at Travel Age West, are there places people can go to find out information like what Carolyn wanted to find out, the impact of their own travels?
Yeah, there's some great sites. There's an organization called the International Ecotourism Society. It's based in Washington, D.C. That's a good place to start. And, you know, I would always recommend also to get a good travel agent who specializes in this sort of travel. They're out there, and they really know their business. So that would be my advice.
Michael's calling from Pasadena with his own suggestion. Michael, go ahead.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Hi, Burma. We went to Myanmar before the recent troubles there because I'm involved in some conservation issues, and we heard that the government was just not doing proper conservation of the wonderful pagodas and monuments. They just whitewash things, and the lifestyle is changing. The Chinese in northern Myanmar are building rapidly. So it was a wonderful trip. They're beautiful people, and I'm just delighted we made the trip, although Lonely Planet made the pros and cons about going to Burma because of the dreadful government, and we opted to go, and we loved it.
Michael, thank you so much. Eric Marinoff with alltravel.com. Are these the kinds of questions people ask you about, look, am I endorsing something horrendous in trying to save something wonderful?
It is something that comes up quite often and quite common. And we've got almost two different types of tourism going on here, that which is a progression of man-made change that's, you know, at least intentional. While we may not like it, it's intentional, versus the progression of change in nature that is not intentional. And our caller before who made reference to going to Antarctica and being, you know, concerned and, gee, am I really causing some damage here, a lot of those destinations are very highly regulated. And as she mentioned, she had to plan way in advance because a limited number of cruise ships are allowed into the destination, and within, they're highly regulated as well. But it is something that people do raise question to and raise conscience of. But it's, you know, if people don't go and spend time, see and do, then all these things are completely forgotten and change will occur anyway. So it is a raising of consciousness.
Lowell from Long Beach has a trip to tell us about. Lowell, thanks for your call.
Hi, good afternoon. Yeah, I went to Cuba, and I went intentionally to be there before Fidel passes away and things inevitably change, hopefully for the better, but I went to see there. Another point I want to make about the trip is you're talking about the footprints that we leave behind, and as many of your listeners won't know, we have a blockade against the country, so to go to Cuba, most Americans have to go through third countries, which would increase that footprint and, you know, increase global warming and whatnot, instead of traveling directly from Miami right into Havana.
So, Lowell, you went to see the sort of almost colonial aspects of Havana, where some of the buildings are preserved because nothing's been built, because the cars, it looked like 1956 right out of Detroit, too.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, it's beautiful, and it changed really my perspective, not just on Cuba, but really about this country. I mean, you go there. I went there as a journalist, but coming back, I had a hard time writing about it, and what it really taught me was about this country. And so I got sort of both the best of both worlds in that respect, but I definitely went because I wanted to see a country under a different dynamic, and it's important for Americans to go and see that before, you know, Fidel passes away, which, you know, inevitably we all will.
And before there may be a Starbucks on every corner. Lowell, thank you so much for your call. if you have an experience of this kind of tourism against in countries that may be undergoing political and social changes, or to places like Antarctica or some glacier, say, in the Alps, give us a call at 866-893-5722. Joseph is calling from Encino about his own travels. Joseph, go ahead.
Hi, guys. I had an interesting trip in March and April. I went to, of all places, Iran, and there's a couple of reasons why. It's been on my list of places to go for some time, and in regards to what you just said, the reason that I chose to go this year was because of the political situation. Who knows what may happen with the footing that the United States has in Iraq right now, with the building, saber-rattling against this country. And a couple of comments that I'll make. UNESCO's World Heritage Sites, two of the biggest are in Iran. One of them is Chorazambil. It's a 15th century BCE ziggurat. And also, a lot of people may recall, Persepolis is also just outside of Shiraz. And for the listeners who may think that it is a dangerous country, it is not. And we have been fed a line of nonsense by the American government about the situation there as far as tourism. And I'd like to listen to the comments that the commentators have about my trip.
Thank you very much, and it sounds like an enviable trip, Joseph. Kenneth Shapiro, first, from Travel Age West. Is there a difference for travelers between the American attitude toward the government of a particular country and vice versa, and the attitude toward visitors?
Yeah, often that is the case, and you see that a lot in the travel industry. You'll see representatives of tourism from countries that are at odds working together because they realize that it's really in both countries' interests. And I think also this kind of tourism to these places often helps, travelers become better informed in terms of the national debate on these issues. And I think that governments and tourism officials realize that as well and see how that this can help you.
And Eric Marinoff with alltravel.com.
Well, I think Ken summarized it very well, in that particular one, he's got it all.
Sarah Benson, we've been hearing people who have been traveling to destinations where the political regimes and not global warming have been changing the face of the place. Which is really more at risk, the places that are being imperiled by their own governments or by global warming?
I think that's an impossible question to answer. I think both kinds of places are teetering on the brink of great change. On the one hand, places that are changing forever in terms of their environment and disappearing, but in terms of political turmoil, these places are going to change. In fact, all countries are constantly evolving, and some are, evolving or changing more rapidly than others. I really liked hearing about the caller's trip to Iran. I think that in a lot of cases, countries that Americans are afraid to visit can be some of the most educational, inspirational, and at times life-changing. It really opens your eyes about what's really going on in the rest of the world. And that kind of enlightened travel is something that I think we all kind of hope for when we visit another country, to change our life, change our perspective on what's going on back here at home.
We'd like to hear about your itineraries. Are you a tourist of doom, a tourist of change? Have you visited places that are changing just because it may not be there or be the same a few years from now? 866-893-5722. Kenneth in Burbank wants to know what place is most likely to disappear in our lifetimes. And I'll put that to Kenneth Shapiro at Travel Age West, who coined the term tourism of doom.
Well, Pat, I think the one that everyone talks about quite a bit is Mount Kilimanjaro, because they talk about the snow caps could disappear within, 10 to 15 years, which is really remarkable. But you hear about, places, all the glaciers in the Alps and in Patagonia, Greenland. There's a enormous change going on in all these places, and I think any of them are really threatened and could be significantly different within a generation.
Margaret is calling from Newport Beach with her experience about a cruise to Greenland. Is that right, Margaret?
Yes. We were just up in Tanqueray Fjord not too long ago, and our passage of choice on these northern trips has been a group of Russian icebreakers that are now refitted at certain times of the year for tourists. And as we climbed over a hill in northern Greenland, from a shore excursion, a little shore hike. I looked down on this pristine bay where our ship was moored, and I saw it belching tons of black smoke. They were cleaning the boilers, and it was such a shock. I realized that we were doing damage by being there. As much as we were discussing Al Gore over dinner, we were part of the problem.
Wow. Was this a Russian ship, Margaret,
yeah,
you said?
There are several of these, and they're kind of lovely funnel boats. And I have to tell you, we've been to the North Pole, to Antarctica, to all kinds of places on these boats, over to Kamchatka, beautiful peninsula at the tip of Russia below Siberia, just as new and as fresh as Alaska must have been 100 years ago.
Oh, boy. Let me ask Kenneth Shapiro. Margaret just sounds heartsick at seeing this, and certainly we know there are different standards for environmental regulations for different countries, but are cruise lines changing their ways?
What you hear a lot from cruise lines is that they are working on new technologies and new ways to bring tourists to some of these places, and it's a very hot topic in the industry. I just got back from the U.S. Tour Operators Association conference in Mexico, and a year ago there might have been a third maybe of companies talking about this topic, but now just about everybody, that's all that they were talking about. So I'm pretty optimistic that there's a lot of people working on these problems, and you do hear of this happening all over the world with certain companies.
George is calling from Santa Monica. George, go ahead. George, are you there? George, have we lost you? I'm afraid that we have lost George here. Patrick is calling from Southgate. Patrick, go ahead, please.
Yes, hello. I'm calling because I think there are some times when visiting places, particularly visiting communities that are being threatened, can actually be helpful to those communities because it brings attention to their situation. I was on a trip last year to Colombia, to the Guajira region of Colombia, to visit communities that are being threatened by the expansion of a coal mine, largest open-pit coal mine in the world. And these are communities which are in a struggle for their survival, and or if they're displaced, for being displaced someplace where they can stay as a community. And the fact of people visiting them from outside can be helpful to them. But of course, in situations like that, it needs to be through somebody who knows the community and can arrange it properly.
Sarah Benson, who's written for Lonely Planet, is there an epiphany among some governments, some regional governments, certainly in parts of the world, who say, gee, you know, here we are digging a coal mine, as we just heard, but people aren't showing up to look at the coal mine. They're coming here and bringing nice dollars to look at what we don't dig up, what we leave intact.
Occasionally, I do believe that it's the government that has the epiphany, but more often I see it's the local community, whether it's the tribal council or, you know, the village, the leaders of the village that are having this realization that actually Western tourists, like the caller was mentioning, can have a positive impact on their side of a specific environmental issue or something that they're fighting to preserve. And I don't think it's necessarily even limited to international destinations. I've seen the same thing in Native American nations in the American Southwest, the Navajo and the Hopi. I think the key is that when the community itself sets the rules for visiting tourists, and tourists come with an open mind and curiosity and respect for those rules, that the most impactful kind of travel can happen in those kinds of communities.
Kenneth Shapiro, the editor-in-chief of Travel Age West, is there a, it sounds, in the light of Tourism of Doom, it sounds odd to say the hot new see-it-before-it's-gone destination, but what is it?
I'm sorry, Pat, I lost you there for a second.
I said it's sort of odd to couple the phrase tourism of doom with the idea of a hot new see-it-before-it's-gone destination, but if so, what would that be?
Well, I think Antarctica is probably, it's kind of ironic, it's probably the hottest destination right now. If you wanted to book a cruise or tour to Antarctica for next season, it would be really difficult. They're selling out. And Alaska is the same way, actually.
And Eric Marinoff, alltravel.com.
We're seeing tremendous strength with Alaska and also a real surge for Africa. And to still really see the animals and the openness of Africa before it gets built up and disappears. But I also think that we really hit on a very key part of the whole process here, and that is that everything in the world is changing and changing rapidly and changing faster than ever before. And that's part of the race that everybody has, is to see as much as they can before it's different than what it is today.
And Sarah Benson, who's written for Lonely Planet Guidebooks, what place do you most worry about when it comes to tourism being too much of a good thing?
Personally, I would have to say island nations, especially in the South Pacific. Not only is the environment fragile, but the local culture can be dangerously impacted by too much tourism. Yet, of course, everyone dreams of that, you know, beautiful beach escape to Tahiti or someplace like that. So I think that islands are in the most peril right now, and they'll always be perennially popular destinations for vacations.
Thank you very much. I appreciate all of your calls out there with your confidences and your ideas about tourism to places that may be doomed, to places that may be changing. My thanks to Sarah Benson, a freelance travel journalist, to Eric Marinoff, the travel agent and owner of alltravel.com, and to Kenneth Shapiro, who is the editor-in-chief of Travel Age West. This is 89.3 KPCC, Southern California Public Radio.
Support for 89.3 KPCC comes from Edison International, committed to building a future where environmental protection and technology unite to make electric power more economical and environmentally friendly.
Skip the hassle of finding a buyer for that unwanted car, truck, or boat. Donate it to KPCC and turn it into a tax deduction. Just give us a call at 877-KPCC-CAR or fill out our online form at kpcc.org and we'll take care of the rest. Thanks.
This is 89.3 KPCC FM with IQ. Good afternoon, I'm Hetty Lynn Hurtis. David Letterman has made a deal with the Writers Guild, allowing him to resume his late-night show on CBS next week with his writers aboard. Most of TV's late-night shows are scheduled to return to the air Wednesday night after being off for 2 months due to the strike, but it's likely that only Letterman and the show that follows him, hosted by Craig Ferguson, will be written by Guild writers. Most California voters are concerned about the state's looming multi-billion-dollar budget deficit. The latest field poll found 9 in 10 voters consider the shortfall to be either a very serious or somewhat serious problem. Estimates have put the gap at roughly $14 billion. The poll also asked voters whether they believed taxes would have to be raised to compensate. Mark DiCamillo directs the field poll.
By a narrow 48% to 43% margin, voters are resigned to the fact that might actually have to happen. That 48% believe that taxes will probably have to be raised. 43% say no.
The poll also finds that voters have more confidence in the governor than they do in the state legislature to resolve the state's budget deficit. The governor's overall approval rating remains fairly steady at 60%. The legislature hasn't changed much either. It's around 39%. Possibility of sprinkles through the day, otherwise partly cloudy through tomorrow with highs in the low 60s.
I'm Pat Morrison. Until a couple of weeks ago, there were two perfect teams in the National Football League. One was the Miami Dolphins, which was perfectly awful, getting no wins on their scoring side until they finally won a game in the very last. Some people were disappointed, but it was the Miami Dolphins that blazed a trail 35 years ago with the first unbeaten regular season record in the National Football League. They went on, of course, to lose the Super Bowl. Now we have the New England Patriots on top with an unbeaten record going into Sunday's big game against the Giants. It's an NFL dynasty already, 3 Super Bowl victories since 2002, but it ain't easy being on top. What kind of superstition, what kind of worries, what kind of fears would be generated in a team that is looking to match a record unmatched in 35 years? Ron Rappaport joins us to talk about that. He's a sports commentator for NPR and a longtime newspaper sports writer as well. Ron, thanks for being here.
You're welcome, Pat. Happy New Year.
And same to you. All right. They must be having butterflies in their stomachs at practice for the Patriots, no?
Yeah, you know, I think so. I think they might lose this game, Pat. I really do. It might not be the worst thing for them. It's hard enough to win a Super Bowl, as you point out. without having to, trying to set history at the same time. The Patriots can afford to lose this game. The Giants really can't. The Patriots have been great. They've been absolutely great, and the loss wouldn't affect what anybody thinks about them going into the Super Bowl. But don't be surprised if this game is a really close one with New England losing.
Are the Giants that good?
No, they're not, but they're hungry. They need this win. Nobody's as good as the Patriots. That's the whole point. You know, the team that I remember was the 85 Bears, which I covered, which won every game in the regular season except a game in Miami on a Monday night when, the fans were howling, and I think there was a full moon and everything was going nuts. But once the playoffs started, that didn't affect the Bears. Every game got easier than the last. They beat the Rams, the Giants shut them out, and then killed New England in the Super Bowl. So a loss would not affect what anybody thinks of the Patriots. They're a great, great team.
Is there a burden of invulnerability when you go this far without having lost a game?
Well, I think so, and I think it would carry into the playoffs, which is why I think that if they just lost a game, then they could start in the regular season, the final game, then they could start the playoffs with a clean slate. Whereas, if they go into the playoffs unbeaten, then every game takes on the sort of monumental stature and status because they're not only trying to win a playoff game and get into and then win the Super Bowl, but to do something historic. Each game sort of feeds off the last one as opposed to starting over with a clean slate.
We hear that athletes are about the most superstitious people in the world. They have favorite socks and favorite bats and favorite jock straps. And what's the hoodoo surrounding a team like the Patriots at this point?
Well, I don't really think there's much of anything. You know, they've got Bill Belichick. I'm sitting here looking at the new Sports Illustrated, Pat, and he's dressed up like Santa Claus with a scowl on his face. And Belichick is very good at not getting excited either up or down. So I think in terms of hoodoo or superstition or any of the rest of it, you take one look at Bill Belichick and you say, that stuff don't matter.
Well, it may not matter to him, but it may to the fans. You may have fans who are lighting candles and doing all sorts of little rituals to guarantee something good for the Patriots come Sunday.
I suppose, although, if there's anybody we don't need to feel sorry for or worried about these days, it's the fans in Boston. You know, the Red Sox have won a couple of World Series. The Celtics are spread-eagling the NBA. The Patriots, as you point out, are going, they're closest thing to a dynasty the NFL has seen in years. And so I don't know what fans in New England and Boston have to worry about or feel sorry about.
I mentioned the Dolphins going almost winless. It was kind of disappointing. I don't know. If you want a perfect season, you might as well go for it.
I suppose, although that really would have been a double whammy, That undefeated Dolphin team you were talking about, Don Shula, that went, the only team that ever went to the Super Bowl and has gone undefeated all season, they're going to be doubly upset if the Patriots match their record. They're on record and have been for years of saying they don't want any team to do that. So if the Patriots are to are to sweep the board, and if the Dolphins had lost every game, that would have been tough.
Would have been one for the books. So now the Patriots came through a bit of a rough time. They had that videotaping scandal.
Yeah, does anybody remember that?
Well, that's the point. It seems like it hasn't done any harm.
Well, in a way, it almost seems to make them even bigger and badder and scarier. Here they cheated, and it's clear that they did because of the nature of the fine shows you what the nature of the infraction was. Losing draft choices and being fined many hundreds of thousands of dollars. It doesn't matter. We'll just go on and win every game anyhow. Do what you want to us. It sort of puts them on another level that, you caught us. Big deal. What difference does it make?
In 2002, when the Patriots won the Super Bowl, it was the first Super Bowl after 9/11, and they were the Patriots after all. New England, the cradle of the United States, except Virginia's going to be unhappy about hearing that. But is it different now? People end up hating dynasties they once loved when they become too dynastic.
No, I don't think so. I think that dynasties give you something to shoot for. You remember how great the Yankees were all those years. Yes, people hated them, but they also sort of focused everybody's attention. It was like either you loved them or you hated them. There was nothing in between. But the point was people were talking about them. And wouldn't you rather have that, even if some of the talk is bad, than to be sort of in the middle of the pack or have people feeling sorry for you or not taking care of you, not worrying about you at all? You can't have a discussion about the National Football League that doesn't be these days. that doesn't begin and end with the Patriots. That's kind of a nice position to be in, I think.
But do the Patriots find themselves being as love them or hate them as the Yankees, you say, or as the Dallas Cowboys were in their heyday?
Well, they're getting there.
The team you love to hate, eventually. And so what are your predictions for Sunday? The Giants want to be Giant killers, in this case Patriot killers. What happens?
Well, I think the Giants may win. Now, you have to know my track record for predictions, Pat. It isn't always that great. But I just think that if there ever were a game where you could see how it might come down for the Giants winning, this would be the one.
And have you spoken to any of your colleagues who cover the Giants about what they're feeling?
No, I really haven't. I'm kind of leaving them alone in this their hour of need here. I think they've got enough on their plate.
Oh, gosh. Well, it comes down as much to, I suppose, to how people are feeling about the game and their own sense of vulnerability or invulnerability as anything that happens on the field.
I think so. Remember, every game, these are all professional players. They're all the best they could find. Anything can happen in any game. It looked as if New England was going to lose a game a couple of weeks ago. They have had a couple of close scares. They don't just go out there and throw the ball out in the field and automatically come away with a win. They still have to win it. And they haven't all been that easy for them. Now, the mark of a good team is to win all kinds of games. You got to win games when you're playing well. You got to win games when your running game isn't good, when your passing game isn't good, when your defense doesn't come up to it. And the fact that New England has won all these games, some by a great margin against good teams and some by a lesser margin against poorer teams, shows you how great they really are.
I ask you about your colleagues covering the Giants. Now I'd like to ask you about a colleague who you've lost, Stu Nahan, who was 81 when he died Wednesday in Studio City. He'd been a minor league hockey goalie. He'd played himself as a character on numerous movies, and he was just a fixture of Southern California sports journalism for a very long time.
Well, he really was. And, you know, Pat, ever since you called and asked me to talk about Stu, I was trying to remember if I had ever been in his company when I wasn't laughing. And the answer is no. Stu had what I consider to be the chief requisite for being a really good sports commentator or writer or broadcaster, and that was a sense of fun. He never took himself or what he was covering all that seriously. There was always a sense when you were around Stu and when you listened to Stu that these were games, and that was important. There was always this business about, you know, athletes and fans. I think there's a certain amount of arrested development in all of us. The fate of the world doesn't hang in the balance, you know. They're just games. They're what give us pleasure or what heighten emotions. And Stu always reflected that. It was always the sense of fun that you found in sports. And I think that's why the people who knew him, his colleagues, really loved the guy, because there always was a little bit of that not very good minor league hockey goalie about him.
Of not being able to take himself and therefore much of the rest of it very seriously.
Let me tell you my favorite story about him, may I?
Please.
Well, he was once going to Seattle to do a basketball play-by-play. This is years ago at the University of Washington. And a young fellow from the local station picked him up at his hotel and was ready to drive him to the arena, but Stu insisted on driving. So he's all dressed up to do the game, and he's smoking a pipe, and he's driving the car. Now, the kid makes some kind of remark, and Stu starts laughing, but he's got both hands on the wheel. So all of a sudden, he's laughing through his pipe, and embers, sparks are flying all over the car, and they light up his shirt. So there are big black streaks and hole all over his shirt and embers all over the car. He gets to the arena, and he's got to do a television show, and there he is in a shirt with big black holes in him. He gives the kid $100 to run out and buy him a shirt, but the kid doesn't get back until after tip-off. So Stu is doing the first quarter of the game with things, books and stuff, piled up in front of him on the table, and no one could see his shirt. However, it's halftime is coming up, and he's got to do an encore interview, stand up. Now the shirt finally comes, just before halftime. It's during a timeout, he gets up in the full view of everybody in the arena, takes off his shirt, standing there naked to the waist, puts on the new shirt so he can do the stand-up at halftime. Standing ovation, Pat. 10,000 people.
He may have missed another career.
Well, it's funny. You know, I just, through strictly just an accident of timing, I, Netflix delivered Fast Times at Ridgemont High the other day.
That was one of the several movies he appeared in. He also was Skipper Stew in Sacramento hosting a children's show. He was Captain Philadelphia doing a children's show in Philadelphia. He was discovered driving a delivery truck when he met the pro sports announcer who was the voice of the L.A. Rams. His entire career seemed to be serendipitous, and he enjoyed that.
I think he really did. And you know, Stew was everywhere. He really was. In many ways, he was the voice of Los Angeles sports. He was just comfortable. Fun to watch, you know, not pretentious. God, anything but pretentious. And he, the thing about him is if you knew him, if you were around him, what he was in person was what he was on the air. And that was, I think, the secret of why everybody felt so comfortable watching him. And why in a business where people come and go, why television stations change personnel and change formats the way you and I change our socks, Stu lasted so long.
He was, in a way, a kind of Hal Fishman of sports. I once had dinner with him and his wife, Sandy, and you're right, we were laughing all the way. And I suppose, do any of his successors have that same quality of insouciance, of not taking things quite so seriously, or are the sports reporters, especially on broadcast, become just as serious as the political reporters? Or maybe the political reporters are funnier and the sports reporters aren't.
God, that's a terrible thing to contemplate. No, I there's some very fine people out there, and a lot of them are very funny, but it's a different era. You know, Stu goes back to an era where there wasn't quite as much money involved. There wasn't quite, and I'm talking about both on television and in sports. There wasn't quite as much concern about the daily ratings and the ups and downs of it, and wondering. It just seemed to be. It was more not experimental, but the business was inventing itself at the time when Stu was going along, was coming along, and was around all those years. And now I think it's different. It's become much more corporate, much more bottom line. And I think what we see on television reflects that a lot. And Stu was from an era where there was less of that involved.
Stu Nahan died at his home at the age of 81. He appeared in all five Rocky films, announcing them, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, of course, as you just heard, and a longtime Los Angeles sports radio and television personality. Ron Rappaport, thanks so much.
Happy to do it, Pat.
Ron Rappaport is a sports commentator for National Public Radio. I'm Pat Morrison. If you missed any part of this broadcast, go to kpcc.org, click on Pat Morrison, or make it easier on yourself and just subscribe to the podcast, and you'll never miss another program.